Still?
Okay.
Thank you, Debbie. Welcome, everyone. Good afternoon. I'm going to call to order the Senate Committee on Workforce. Today is Wednesday, April 26, 2017. And we are going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2005A. That is, I'm going to go ahead and open that up so we can start talking about it. Deborah is going to summarize the bill that passed out of the House. I want to let folks know that Senator Knope and I and others have been working on this bill over here on the Senate side, and our legislative council is very, very busy, and they have drafted an amendment to the bill. It is what is called Dash 25. However, it's on OLIS, it's under meeting materials. It's not under the amendments because it hasn't gone through what we call editing, meaning the making sure all the T's are crossed and I's are dotted. However, we have the drafter, Jessica Santiago, is here, and she's going to walk us through what the Dash 25, what the amendment does to the bill, the changes to the House bill. And I just want to make certain that everyone's on the same page. It's more or less, more or less a gut and stuff, what we call changing the bill from the House. So just want to make sure everyone's on the same page. I'm going to have Deborah summarize the House bill, and then we'll have Jessica Santiago come up from Legislative Council and tell us about the Dash 25, which are the changes to the bill. Please.
House Bill 2005A came from House Committee on Business and Labor. Chief sponsors included Senator Taylor, Representative Leininger, Bynum, and Lively. The bill makes unlawful employment practice to discriminate in the payment of wages or other compensation on the basis of a protected class, provides that employer may pay employees for equivalent work at different compensation levels based on merit, seniority, production, or bona fide factors such as education, training, or experience if criteria are met. Makes unlawful employment practice to screen applicant based on their salary history or to determine compensation based on applicant's or employee's salary history. Allows the use of salary history for internal hires and transfers. Expands remedies for pay equity violations and retaliation for wage inquiries and wage claims to include right to compensatory and punitive damages and jury trial. Extends the time limitation to bring the claim by making actionable each payment based on the underlying discriminatory practice. Extends the tort claim notice from 180 days to 1 year for public employees alleging pay equity violations.
Okay. All right. So thank you. And so I'm going to ask Jessica Santiago come up from LC to tell us about the Dash 25, please. And committee members, I had it printed for you. You have the version in front of you just in case you had any, so you can have something to look at if you can't find it online. So,
good afternoon, okay. Chair Taylor, members of the committee. My name is Jessica Santiago, and I'm with Legislative Council. And as Senator Taylor mentioned, I'm going to walk you through what is at this point a work draft of the Dash 25. So again, let me just be clear, this hasn't gone through our editors. So we haven't, if there's spelling mistakes and maybe some misnumbering, it hasn't gone through the final edit yet. So, and again, this version is actually going to be a gut and stuff of the Angros version of the House bill. So it's going to replace everything that was in the House bill. So with that, we'll just go section by section and walk through it. So one of the changes that you'll notice is in Section 1, we've added a definition for an equal pay analysis, and basically what that is, it's an evaluation process that will allow employers to assess and then, after that assessment, correct any wage disparities that were identified among employees who perform work of comparable character. We've also added a definition for protected class to cover race, color, religion, sex, sexual orientation, national orientation, marital status, veteran status, disability, or age. And I believe that we made that an actual defined term, but the biggest change to that is we've added veteran status to that protected class.
Can I ask a question?
Oh, yes, Senator Gilson.
Why is gender not included?
So that's actually, sorry, Senator Taylor, Senator Yeltsin. I think gender was already included in the original statutes that we're amending with this bill, and that's covered under sex, and under sex, which is one of the...
Oh, sex. Sorry. Yeah. Thank you.
So moving along, we've defined the term veteran status to mean... Well, a veteran status is a veteran as defined under what's already in law, which is referenced here, 408-225. And that does it for the definition section of the bill. So moving along, we kept intact the amendments to ORS 652-220, which are basically the wage claims. So it's essentially the same as you saw it in the House bill, where the amendment makes it an unlawful employment practice to basically differentiate or compensate these certain protected classes based on that protected class. So there's also several exceptions to the prohibition on the discriminatory wage practices, and those are basically listed in subsection 2, and they're items like seniority system. So basically, an employer has an opportunity to show that if they meet certain bona fide factors, then they're not considered in violation of the prohibition on discriminatory wages, because they're basically showing that the differential is justified by something such as a seniority system or a merit system, a system that measures earnings by quantity or quality of production, workplace location, travel if travel is necessary, and then we've any differential that's based on a bona fide factor other than on the basis of a protected class. So those are some of the changes that you'll see here. And what that means is basically if an employer can show that they meet one of those bona fide factors, then the pay differential is justified, and it's not considered to be a pay differential in violation of the statute.
Yes, Senator Gelsinger.
So that would that be broad enough to not, for instance, have a lower wage for somebody that was perceived to be a parent, that be a parent of a child, that the expectation would be this person will be less focused at work because she has small children at home. Would this leave room?
Well, Senator Taylor, Senator Yeltsin, we haven't carved out like a parental status to be one of the protected classes. So at this, I mean, the way that it's written currently, that would not be one of the protected classes. So
I guess I was asking, follow up?
Yes, Senator.
Not so much a protected class, but it says a differential based on a bona fide factor. Could an employer make the argument that my bona fide factor is this person is a single mother to three small children and therefore may need to take time off work or may... I mean, could people make a leap from that? Again, that's not a direct gender argument, but it is one that I know that I've had women talk to me that they have faced that could be described as a bona fide factor that isn't because you're a mother, because you're a woman, but because this factor that you have these responsibilities outside of work.
Senator Taylor, Senator Yeltsin, I think that if you look at the different categories of these bona fide factors, that would not be in line with those. Usually a court will look at what's listed as factors that are including but not limited to and use that as kind of like the standard of things that would qualify. I don't know exactly, we could tighten it to say that, but I don't think that it would qualify as a bona fide factor because of the types of bona fide factors that are listed. It's like the skills, the training, experience, merit, things of that nature. And so if I'm understanding correctly, to base it on someone's status as a parent.
I just think if there is a way to tighten that up, because that is an issue that arises and has come up, and if you're not sure.
So if I may,
Thank you, Senator Gilser. Jessica, let's go back to on page 2, yes. Line 7. It says one of the protected classes is marital status.
Well, but that's not.
You said single mom.
Yeah.
So that's meaning like you can't.
Well, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'd have to double check to make sure
okay,
that
we can double check.
Status,
absolutely.
Let's
get all the questions answered now. I would like to think, and you can look into it for us, Ms. Santiago,
yeah,
that
absolutely.
In some other section of our great land of laws in the state of Oregon or in the United States, that the scenario that Senator Gelser brought forward is not allowed. You're not allowed to discriminate on that basis in another way. So let's hope that that's not the case. But yes,
I
please look into that.
I will follow up with you on that.
Okay.
Move along?
Yeah, move along, please.
Okay. So we're still in section 2.
Yes.
So everything that remains is essentially the same that was in the House bill. We've kept intact that an employer may not reduce the compensation level of an employee in order to comply with the requirements
Important.
Of this provision. An employee who asserts a violation under this section still has the ability to file a complaint, a BOLI complaint. One of the changes that we did make is, this is the same as in the House version, so you can also file a civil action under the discrimination mm-hmm. claims, which are under 659A885.
Okay, so then section 3.
One of the changes that you'll see here is that in the Angress version, in the House bill, there was a right of action that was available under the wage claims, which was ORS 652230. We've taken that out, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But this new Section 3 makes it an unlawful practice, so an unlawful practice under the discrimination chapter, so ORS Chapter 659A, for an employer basically to ask about the salary history of an applicant or employee. So that's one of the changes you'll see.
Okay.
And then Section 4, which used to deal with the statute of limitations under the discrimination claims, that has now been replaced. We're amending ORS 30275, and what that pertains to is the notice that's required for employees if they're going to file an action against a public body. So in the House bill, we actually had that as a provision, a subsection in Section 4 that said, notwithstanding ORS 30275, that notice of a claim against a public body must be given within 1 year of discovery of the alleged loss or injury. So instead, rather than notwithstand that provision, we just directly amended it here. So it's the same change. You'll just see it differently here. So I believe you mentioned, Deborah mentioned in the measure summary that, again, it's extending the notice requirement from 180 days for public employers to a year.
Which is the same as in the private sector.
Yes.
Okay. So now.
So the next few sections, Section 5 is just a technical change. It's basically making a conforming amendment because, as I mentioned, we are taking out the wage claim, the civil action, the right of action under the wage claim statutes, and moving everything over into the unlawful discrimination statutes. So that's where the civil action is housed now. So with that, we had to make some conforming amendments to what was already in statute. So in Section 5 of this -25 version, 652-990 deals with the criminal penalties, which are associated with the violation of the prohibition on discriminatory wage rates. And what we've done here is just made conforming technical changes to reflect that the civil damages that are recoverable are now under the discrimination statutes, and also that since we're getting rid of a part of the series, that we're just pulling out the violation of the specific wage claim, which is now 652220. So this is has always been in statute. We're just making technical changes to conform. The next few sections, 6 through, looks like 8, those are added also just to, they're basically technical changes, and it's just cross-referencing where an employee has the right to file a complaint with Bowley. We're just making sure that the specific violation of that wage claim is added to all of the statutes that pertain to the Bowley complaint process. So the complaint itself, the investigation process, the findings, so on and so forth. And then that again is sections 6 through 8. And then what was section 4 relating to the time limitations for a claim, a civil action under 659885 is now, that's now been moved to section 9. And that is virtually the same except for when I mentioned that we pulled out the notice for the public bodies. That's now in its own section. So everything is the same with respect to the tolling piece. The fact that for the time limitations, if there's been a compensation practice that was based in an unlawful practice, that triggers every single time that compensation is paid. So that provision remains the same. Moving on to Section 10, this is where the civil action now lies. And you'll see that we've specifically mentioned ORS 652220 with respect to the actions that may be brought under this statute. And you'll notice on page 15 of this that there's a lot of bold, and that is dealing with primarily the available remedies that are available under this particular statute. And those are all the same that have been, that were in the House version of the bill, namely compensatory and punitive damages and the right of a party to get a jury trial upon request. One of the changes that we made in this particular draft is provided some clarification with respect to the award for punitive damages. So we've just laid out that a court shall consider in the award of punitive damages a factor that if an employer has essentially engaged in fraud or acted with malice or willful or wanton misconduct, and if there's basically a pattern, like a repeat offender of an employer, that the court must consider these factors when contemplating an award of punitive damages. And then in subsection 5, this is also a change that's specific to this version of the bill. This is where the equal pay analysis comes in. So basically this gives an employer an opportunity to perform this equal pay analysis of the employer's pay practices. And if an employer can show that they've conducted this pay analysis and can also show that the analysis was reasonable in light of the size of the employer, how many employees the employer has, and that the analysis was directly related to any protected class that was asserted by the plaintiff in this action. So basically, the employer is looking at the cause of action. So if someone's claiming there is an unlawful pay violation on the basis of gender, the pay analysis is geared towards looking at that. And the employer must also show that they have eliminated any wage differential for the protected class that's asserted in the claim, so that it actually addresses the harm that was caused to that plaintiff who has commenced the action, and also eliminated wage differentials for other protected classes that were identified, these pay differentials that were identified in the pay analysis. If an employer can show that, then the damages are limited to 2 years back pay and costs and reasonable attorney's fees. so the court may not award, in that instance, compensatory and punitive damages. So that's the pay analysis piece, or the pay equity, the equal pay analysis, excuse me. And then moving along with that, if a equal pay analysis is undertaken and an employer can show that, that evidence is limited to these specific types of claims. So you can't use that as evidence in any other proceeding. It's limited to the civil action with respect to a violation of the wage claim. And on the flip side of that, if an employer has not completed this analysis, that's not like a presumption of evidence that the employer is automatically in violation of the equal pay statute. And finally, everything else in that is the same as it was in the House bill. We moved to the last page of this, and sections 11 through 15 deal with the repeal of the right of action that was available to employers, I'm sorry, to employees under the 652-230. And now that's been moved into the employment discrimination statutes. Again, that's 659A885. So that civil action is still available. It's just basically the violation of the discriminatory wage rates was, there was a civil action in two different statutes, and they were providing two different sets of available remedies. So they're now all housed under the discrimination statutes, and an employee may not commence an action under the old 652-230 on or after January 1, 2019. So that gives employers, I think, over a year to move into this new scheme here. And then that statute is repealed by Section 12. But with that, anything that is already, that may be pending, so let's say someone filed, an employee filed a claim under 652-230 on December 31st, 2018, as that's pending, the repeal of that statute doesn't affect any of the rights or obligation that are pending. And then there's an effective date of 91 days after the Legislative Assembly adjourns, sine die. So those are the main changes to the dash with the dash 25s.
Thank you. Before I ask my question, committee members, Ms. Santiago has worked so hard on this, and she has put hours and hours into this and has put a tremendous amount of thought and research into all of these changes, and I just really want to thank her for her professionalism and her thoroughness. It's been fantastic. The one of the things that I want to clarify is about the effective date. So we have the January 1 of 2019 here. However, the provision in the bill that says that an employer cannot ask an employee about how much what their past salary history has mm-hmm. been, that goes into effect 91 days after sine die, correct?
Correct.
Okay, just want to clarify that. Okay. Does anybody have any questions?
I may. Thank you. I'm trying to understand better in Section 10. So if an employee makes a claim that that they are not being equally paid on the, let's say it's disability, on the basis of disability, mm-hmm. and they go to make that claim, the employer then shows that they had done this analysis, and maybe in the past they had not paid people with disabilities equally, and they corrected that for, you know, 2.5 years ago for the people with disabilities, the person with disabilities that was working there. But this new person then comes and they have started it again, that there would be no liability for that. I mean, if you've corrected it one time but don't is there an obligation to change your business practices overall and moving forward, or only for the people that are employed by you at the time that you do this pay differential analysis and you correct that differential? What holds the employer accountable to maintain that change in practice after that time?
Senator Taylor, Senator Gelser. So the way that it's crafted here, and I think I failed to mention that, is first off that the employer needs to undertake, it needs to show that the pay analysis was conducted within 3 years prior to the commencement of any action. So there is, let's say someone comes and an employee files a civil action alleging a violation of the discriminatory wage rate statute. An employer needs to show that 3 years prior to that, that they have conducted this equal pay analysis, and that it was not only related, I mean, it needs to be related to what was asserted in the claim, basically. So if that's different than what the pay analysis was focused on prior, then we have a problem there. But also the employer has to show that they've eliminated wage differentials for the protected class asserted in the action and any other protected class. So if the result of the pay audit or the equal pay analysis was negative, basically meaning that there were discriminatory compensation practices, and the employer hasn't cured, then they won't meet these criteria.
Could I follow up, though?
Yeah, so then, follow up. So just to jump in here, that they would then be subject. This section here that is about making it so that an employer can come forward, and I mean, when a civil action is filed, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Ms. Santiago, so I file a civil action, and the employer comes forward and says, I have done an equal pay analysis over the last 3 years. Here are the results, and I am now showing why I'm paying one person differently than another. They will have to show to the judge in the court, they will have to show at that time, before they go to trial, mm-hmm. okay, at that time they'll have to show, and there's criteria spelled out here, the sideboards, of what is done in a pay evaluation. So a large employer can't just come in with a little old spreadsheet and say, here it is. I mean, they have to have a pay analysis. Then if they do not meet that criteria, or if the employee says, you know what, I don't believe the analysis, I think it was done incorrectly, or I still think I've been discriminated against, then they would have the opportunity to still go forward with their case. This just gives an opportunity for the employee to work with the employer to, if there is something that they want to challenge, that they gets corrected at the time, and then you would be allowed to get up to 2 years of back pay, but the employer, you would not be able to sue them for compensatory and punitive damages above the 2 years of back pay and costs and legal fees. And it's putting sideboards on what the damages are if an employer is conducting an equal pay analysis within a 3 year period of time.
And so the place that I get lost in that, and yes. is the way that it's constructed here, it's not kind of on the front end. It's the court may award back pay only for the 2 year period, dot, 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 but may not award compensatory or punitive damages. So at this point in the process, the way I read this, we're at the point where the employee has made the allegation. The court has determined that, yes, the person has not been paid equitably because the court is determining, am I going to award the back pay and the attorney fees, or am I going to award that and the compensatory or punitive damages? So the question that I'm asking is the requirement, I don't understand how this section works if a company has in good faith done that equal pay analysis within the prior 3 years and cured the issue for the same class that is now bringing the complaint, and the judge is at the point of deciding, is it 2 years back pay or are there compensatory damages because the court has found that the individual is being paid less as a protected class. I just don't understand how the two pieces come together. Is there an obligation for a permanent cure, or could a person cure it then and then restart the discriminatory pay? Because if they've done all these things, there should never be a point where
that's exactly what we're trying to. The intention here is to craft it in such a way that there is enough of an incentive for an employer to make certain that they're paying people equitably, mm-hmm. and if they are, then if And when there is a discrepancy, hopefully there won't be a discrepancy, because we're trying to motivate employers to pay people equitably. If an employee says, I do think that there is, I don't believe this analysis, or I don't believe that this is the case, I think I'm being discriminated, it's because I'm a woman, or whatever the situation is, then they would go and file a civil action. And then it would be the employee with the employer, and they would say, the judge would say, what is your evidence?
Right.
And they would say, well, here is my pay analysis, and do you have a bona fide reason of why you're paying one person more than another? And they would say, here is my bona fide reason. And the judge may say, okay, I accept that. Or they may say, you know what, that's not sufficient evidence. And then the employee would then have the opportunity to go to a full trial.
Right. And I get that. I'm just not sure that this language does that, because you're at the point where the decision of the award of damages is being done. So clearly wrongdoing has been found. If the judge is determining, is it 2 years of back pay, or is it the punitive damages? I guess if the idea is to keep it from getting to that point, I'm not sure how this stops it from getting to the point of the judge making the award. If this kicks in at the point the judge is saying, am I going, or the court, I'm not an attorney.
I'll have Ms. Santiago. Perhaps she can explain it better than I can. So.
Senator Taylor, Senator Gelser. So I think that the intent of this provision is to give an opportunity for the employer at the front end, before going through this entire trial, saying, I've taken these proactive steps already. We've already addressed the pay differentials, and I guess it showed that we had discriminatory practices. So we've already addressed that, and we've eliminated all of our wage differentials on the basis of protected class. So at that point, it's like you wouldn't go forward, because there are no longer, because that's one of the criteria, that they have to have eliminated the pay differential based on a protected class. So they've cured it, and so you don't have to go through the entire trial to prove that. Doing this pay, doing this analysis establishes that at the front end, and then the damages are limited.
But why would there be damages if it was permanently cured? I mean, it just, if it had been cured, then why would you ever need the back pay? Because if it's cured...
Well, that's what we're hoping, but we want to leave the opportunity for an employee to challenge the... If they don't believe that the pay analysis is correct, then they should have the ability to file a civil action and say, I don't believe the pay analysis. So the idea is, this is intentionally drafted so that hopefully we won't have people going to court. Hopefully we're going into a new chapter a new chapter of history here, if you will, and companies are going to be looking through a new lens about how they pay people. And we want to incentivize businesses to do their pay reviews and then make it equitable. And then if it's equitable, then there wouldn't be much of a motivation to have a case. But I think that if you want to have the language clarified, we can do that.
I think that would help
problem.
Me, because I understand where you're trying to get. It just seems that if we get to that point where there is the award of the pay for the back 2 years, that person has been injured, I don't understand why we would take away the compensatory damages, because that would show that there had been a problem with that.
So the employee would, at that time, in that scenario, the employee would have the opportunity to go to trial, and they would be allowed to sue for compensatory and punitive damages if it went to trial. If the employee was actually the aggrieved party and they prevailed in that first interaction with the court, mm-hmm. then they would have the option. They would say, yes, I do want to go to a full trial.
Okay.
It's just making it so that everything doesn't, all cases don't have to go to a full trial.
Okay. And I'm slowing everybody down with my case.
That's okay.
So I can follow
up. Okay.
Like, I'm just stuck on, why would there ever be the case of the 2 years of back pay if it had been cured?
Hopefully we won't have that. It'll only be the rare case where that happens. That will be the ideal scenario. Okay. Thank you. Does anyone have any other questions? Because we have some folks here, Representative Leininger and Ms. Solomon, are waiting patiently here. Representative Solomon, rather. Okay, well, you could be on standby, please. I'm sure we'll have more questions for you. Thank you very much. And we'll, let's, if you want to put your, do some additional thinking on the, some of the comments Senator Gelser made and see if we can clarify the language a little bit more, we can certainly do that. Okay? Okay, great. So Representative Leininger, Representative Solman, and we'll have Alana Gainey from the Governor's Office come and testify. Representative Leininger, this is our chief sponsor from the House. And so we'll have you start, if you would, please.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being patient, everybody. We're a thorough committee. We like to answer, ask our questions. We like to get to the bottom of things.
Well, we appreciate it very much. Thank you, Chair Taylor and Vice Chair Knope and members of the committee. I'm Ann Leininger from House District 38, which is Lake Oswego in Southwest Portland. And I'm really pleased to be here today in support of House Bill 2005A. You have just heard a lot of information about modifications. And I'm going to quickly summarize what I think are the key points that if I were in your shoes, I would really want to hear summarized. So, of course, what the base bill does is clarify that compensation includes bonuses, fringe benefits, and equity type compensation. So that's updating it to the realities of what how people are really paid now. It clarifies what comparable work is, and so the premise is, you know, you have to have a bona fide reason to pay people differently if they're doing comparable work. It expands the protected classes to a number of additional classes. The base bill includes people with disabilities, a wide range of additional classes, and with the amendment, it includes veterans. It prohibits the screening of job applicants based on prior salary history prior to making an offer of employment that includes compensation. It clarifies when pay differential is okay, because, of course, a key point in all this is that pay differentials are okay if they're based on reasonable bona fide business reasons. And so the amendment calls out specifically some additional things that will per se be bona fide business reasons or will be reasonable bases for differential pay. Our perspective in the House was that those were already encompassed because they were reasonable things like quality of work. If someone does good work and someone does not so good work, then the person who does good work, higher quality work, may be paid more. If someone has to travel a lot, they may be paid more. If they work in Portland and someone else works in Phoenix, down where I grew up, you know, there could be a reasonable pay differential based on different costs of living. But that's expressly called out in the amendment, and I think that that's positive. And I think that including
I just want to clarify one thing, Representative Leininger, is that you're talking between the 2005 A bill and the -25
right.
working draft. Just want to make sure we're talking all.
What I'm trying to summarize, because I think I at least heard a whole lot of things in the preceding presentation, which were very valuable, but I thought it might be useful for you to hear sort of a synthesis of what I see as the key additional points in case that's helpful. And I really applaud the work of Senator Knope and Senator and Chair Taylor for teamwork that you've done to help bring in these good additions. So the base bill prohibits reducing other people's pay to rectify pay discrimination. The base bill indicates that the statute of limitations is refreshed at each paycheck and that the statute of limitations for bringing a claim is the same if you're a public sector employee and a private sector employee. So instead of having the public sector folks have 6 months and the private sector folks have a year, it is a year for everyone. And it strengthens penalties by, in some instances, making compensatory and punitive damages available. I really appreciate the work that the vice chair and the chair of this committee have done to define what constitutes a pay equity study, because, of course, it is important to try to avoid these problems on the front end and make sure that the study, which is intended to be preventative, actually really prevent, because it's robust and it's relevant and it suits the size and the scope of the company that is doing it. And I think that the language that you've added is good in that way. I also think that the draft -25 amendment is useful in that if an employer shows that it's done those things and has also taken action to correct a disparity, then even if they're potentially liable for back pay in some other situation, they wouldn't have to pay compensatory and punitive damages. So it sort of shields the level of exposure that they have because they took the good faith step of doing a robust, relevant, suitably tailored pay equity study to try to prevent problems. So the kind of the trade-off that's happening here is that as an incentive to try to avoid problems on the front end by doing really what I think you effectively defined as a robust and relevant study, you don't prevent a plaintiff from recovering anything, which is a really important distinction from other models that have been discussed, but you do prevent the employer from having to pay punitive and compensatory damages so that the plaintiff would still be made whole and get any differential in pay, and their costs and fees would still be available, but the kind of more extraordinary damages would be taken off the table. So I'm still, like you probably, this isn't even on OLIS under amendments yet, so it's fresh. I'm still wrapping my mind around all the elements of it. And it would be premature for me to say, gosh darn it, I'm on board, because there are significant changes from the House version. But I will tell you, gosh darn it, I appreciate the real good faith work that has gone into trying to find a path forward that can draw broad support in the Senate. And I'm hopeful that as I further familiarize myself with this draft and make sure that I'm not missing any elements of what it does or what it doesn't do, because I got to really study it, make sure I'm not missing an issue, I'm hopeful that we can get to a place where I will support the amendments that you are considering, and hopefully we can get something that passes through both chambers and does real good for people and sets Oregonians on a path to fair compensation all around. So good work, Vice Chair Knope and Chair Taylor and members of the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Leininger. Representative Sullivan, hello, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, nice to see you.
See you. Chair Taylor and Vice Chair Knope, my name and members of the committee. My name is Janine Sullivan. I am the state representative for House District 30, Western Washington County, and I am honored to be here today to testify on behalf of House Bill 2005. In this bill, I was thrilled that this was going to be addressed once I was elected, and I'm honored to sit before you today in the Senate, just a few steps away from leading the nation in pay equity. Equal pay for equal work for women of this state is a critical step to take in order to leverage equality between men and women. It is beyond time that the playing field be level in Oregon. And I just wanted to come to you today with perhaps a little bit of a different perspective than what you may hear. In December, I visited Shannon Jones' fourth grade classroom at Quatama Elementary School, and these kiddos were very interested in learning my plans and what I was going to do in Salem. They were very excited because some of them had seen my commercial on YouTube, and they were all raising their hands, asking all these questions. And a girl raised her hand, and she said, "So you said equal pay for women. Are you really going to do that?" And then another gal, a young girl, raised her hand and said, "When you say equal pay for women, do you mean biracial women too?" And it broke my heart that at such a young age that these girls were already aware of the issue, especially for women of color. At the same time, it also gave me a feeling of hope and encouragement that these young girls were willing to speak up and ask these questions on issues that they really care about. I went back to the classroom last month, and we talked more on the issue. Paola mentioned that when she watches TV with her mom, she sees how the media portrays women compared to the men in her favorite TV series, and it disappointed her. And it's not just the girls that notice this and shared concern in Mrs. Jones's class. Sebastian said it would make him sad and uncomfortable if he was doing the same job as a woman, but got paid more. He said she has a family to raise too. And Dannon said that his mom has been going to school for a long time, and when she was done, she told him that she could still make less than the men in her profession as a physical therapist. And Aiden Aiden raised his hand, and he raised it up pretty high. He was pretty excited. And he said that if it happened, well, he would just go to the manager and he'd quit, because being fair was very important to him. These are fourth grade students. So I'm hoping that we can be an example for this country. But more importantly, I think it really makes a strong statement for all the young girls and boys who are in the classrooms right now. They're worth fighting for, and their skills should determine their pay level rather than their gender. And as I am I'm a school board member in Hillsboro, and as I sat and talked to my fellow school board members after that visit, I turned to them and I said, these kids are watching and they're listening, and they're thinking that this is not fair, and I believe we can fix it. So colleagues, I strongly encourage you to join me in supporting this House bill, and I really appreciate this opportunity to testify in front of you today.
Thank you. Hello, Alana.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Senator Taylor, Chair Taylor, members of the committee, for having me here today. For the record, my name is Ilana Pertle-Guinney. I'm with the governor's office. I'm here before you today on behalf of the governor, testifying on a concept that I testified on actually earlier this session before you all. And I'm here to reiterate Governor Brown's support for moving the state forward on pay equity, which is a critical issue for so many workers in our state. Since that time, the bill language has changed a little bit. I know there are more amendments that you all are considering, but it's critical that we see a bill pass this session that will ensure that workers in Oregon are not facing unequal pay for the work they do. I know Governor Brown is looking forward to signing such a bill into law, and I just encourage you all, as you work together and work with your colleagues in the House, to figure out the right language to make sure that it is strong and addresses the real issues that some workers in Oregon do still face, despite the fact that we all agree that this issue should have been solved long ago. Thank you for having me.
Great, thank you. Does anybody have any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it. All right, so let's go ahead and we will bring up Betsy Earls. And let's see here. So what's the, is Piper Sweeney here or not? Betsy is, you're here. Thank you. Please come up. Is Piper Sweeney here? No? And Juanita Lint, is she here? Oh, yes. I think she's testified before. But, and then we have, I can't quite read these. And we have Jenny Dresser. Jenny wants to come up. Sorry, we have these carbon copies, and then by for some reason we get the one I have to actually read off of is the one that's all faint. So I apologize. Well, so then the next panel up we'll have after this, so people can get ready, is Kate Newall, Trish Gardner, and Lori Cremona Wagner. So, okay, who would like to start for the three of you?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries. And I am appearing before you today just to talk a little bit about where I think we are with House Bill 2005 and the Dash 25 amendments. We, just like all of you, just saw them about an hour ago for the first time, and we're still looking through them. But I wanted to let you know that we very, very much appreciate all the work that has been done so far on them. I think some significant progress has been made, and there are a number of things in there that will really make a big difference to employers. I just want to call out in particular the fact that the implementation date has been delayed. This is something that when we worked on the paid sick time law two sessions ago, I think we all realized later probably would have been a big help if we had managed to think that up and included in the bill, just because there was so much work to do in implementation, even of paid sick time, which I think has somewhat less of an impact on companies in some ways than this bill even does. So I believe that by stretching out the implementation date on this bill, it will make a big difference to companies that are working to improve the pay equity situation within their own organizations. The other thing that I appreciate, and we are currently analyzing, is the self-audit on I'm sorry, I really meant not to say self-audit, the self-evaluation on pay equity that companies are being encouraged to do through the inclusion of the defense in the bill. We think that that will also make a really big difference for employers in terms of educating them about what is important and helpful in terms of determining which employees are being paid how much and whether that makes sense based on the bona fide justifications within the bill. So I guess the long and short of it is that we look forward to working with the chair, the vice chair, and the rest of the committee in continuing our discussions on the bill, and we appreciate where we are right now. I think I better leave it there.
Chair Taylor and members of the committee, I'm Juanita Lind, co-owner of Plum Hill Vineyards in Gaston. I spent the bulk of my career in a male-dominated business and was paid very well. But I'm here today to talk to you about 2005 and to tell you that it really does nothing to solve the equal pay issue. In fact, instead, what it really does is it restricts small businesses from hiring the right people and from paying them properly. There are existing laws in place today to help us with equal pay, and those laws need to be enforced. What's on the books with 2005 is will just increase the chances of the threat of lawsuits, and there are many reasons why people in similar jobs are paid differently, and these are legitimate reasons. Many of those are addressed in the bills, but there are lots of them that aren't addressed in the bill, and some of them are somewhat subjective. This bill puts the ownership of proving this on the employer and requires a lot of effort on the part of the employer to figure out. That effort is expensive, and it takes the key management people away from growing the business to do such things as these studies. What I suggest is that instead of focusing on a new bill and creating a defensive situation between employer and employee, why don't we just support the existing federal and state laws and continue to support a fair relationship between employees and employers, and not burden the small businesses with additional paperwork?
Okay, thank you.
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Dressler, and I represent the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. We are here today with similar comments to Betsy Earls and AOIOBA, opposing the base bill as it is, but looking forward to working with the committee on amendments to address some of the concerns of family businesses. Farm Bureau doesn't disagree, our members don't disagree with equal pay for equal work. However, as drafted, House Bill 2005 creates new liabilities for our members who are trying to do the right thing. And this bill, I think a big issue for us is that this bill invites costly litigation against our members. And there are several exemptions listed in the Dash 25 amendments for bona fide reasons, and I'll discuss a couple of those later that are very important to us. But our concern is that those aren't necessarily going to stop the litigation. It gives employers a defense, but for many of our members, they are so small that they're going to be kind of forced into a sue and settle situation where they're still going to have a cost, but they just don't have the kind of resources to go to court and fight those. So I think that's why the Oregon Farm Bureau is supporting the provision that would allow employers to evaluate inequities in their pay systems and to fix those without being forced into a courtroom. So that'll be a provision that we look forward to working with you all on. Additionally, many of our members are family businesses and don't have professional HR departments, which makes a lot of this pretty tricky. But they can't afford the risk of lawsuits, and so we would ask the committee to reconsider the punitive damages that are throughout the Dash 25 amendments. We also wanted to throw our support behind, I think it's Section 2.2 sub C, which allows for differential pay for both quality and quantity piece rate work. In agriculture, that's very widely utilized both for fruit and vegetable picking, but also for sheep shearing. You have variable rates across different areas of the state for different quality of fleece. So that is an important distinction for us and one that I think is very critical to our members. So we would ask for your support of that provision as well. And I'm available for any questions. Thank you.
Does anybody have any questions for this panel? Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so let's go ahead and bring up Kate Newall, Trish Gardner, and Lori Cremona Wagner, please. And then before we start, we'll have on standby, we'll have I see Hasina Squires wanted to testify, and then we'll have Steve Ferrer and Ann, is that say Krishner from Marion County, on standby, please.
Okay.
Ms. Newhall, why don't we have you start, please?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Kate Newhall, here today testifying on behalf of Family Forward Oregon. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2005A. Family Forward supports this bill to address pay inequity in Oregon. And I do, before starting, want to commend the work of both Representative Leininger, Chair Taylor, and Senator Canope in, I think, working on additional amendments to address some concerns that we have raised and opponents have raised the bill. I'm hopeful that we can get to a place that we find some resolution to the issues that I think we've all identified. It's unfortunate that today in 2017, equal pay for equal work is still a far off reality for many women. In 2017, women in Oregon and across the US are still being paid lower wages than men simply because they are women. I will spare you the parts of my testimony that go through more of the technical pieces of House Bill 2005A, because I think now we're thinking about more of these new amendments that have just come out on OLIS. But I do want to say that, from my perspective, I encourage the committee to stay away from amendments that would potentially create unnecessary loopholes in the equal pay protections that we are trying to create. In particular, I just want to put on the record concerns that I had with the affirmative defense language that was included in the minority report that the House considered, and I know has been up for conversation over here in the Senate side. I think the affirmative defense language might appear to provide employers with a good incentive to ensure that they're paying their employees correctly, but I also fear that it risks more harm than it does good. I think amending a bill to allow for a self-evaluation and giving an affirmative defense because an employer has made reasonable progress towards ending pay disparity without actually eliminating them is a dangerous precedent to be setting. So I do commend the work that is in the new amendments to try and get to a standard where we're protecting employers from liability if they have actually eliminated pay disparity. I will also say that, like everybody else, I have just gotten these amendments in the last hour. I appreciate the work that has gone into them. I think we are heading in the right direction, but I would like a little bit more time just to actually be able to look and go through those more closely. But I guess I would say I also have concerns that I don't think are necessarily before this committee at this time, but have been a subject of conversation about creating broad or weak definitions of what is a business necessity. I think the way that the bill, House Bill 2005A, is currently drafted creates a good standard for what is a legitimate area and scenario where you could be paying a pay differential because of a business necessity. And the things that I think of in that are things like if you have customer base that is a Spanish-speaking population and you need to have customer service individuals that can speak Spanish to interact with those customers, but not all of your employees need to have those skills. I think that is a legitimate, reasonable business necessity to have a pay differential for the individuals that have those language skills or special certifications. I want to be important about careful about including broad terms that might say a business necessity is something that's just something that the business deems as important. I think it has to be actually a legitimate business necessity and linked to the business needs for them. So I guess my plea to this committee, and I look forward to continuing to work on these amendments, is I want to see House Bill 2005 establish meaningful equal pay standards in Oregon. I want to make sure that as we're strengthening equal pay standards, that we're not also unintentionally creating loopholes that undermine the protections of the bill. So when I'm looking at these amendments, that is always the eye that I'm looking for. I know that this is a problem that we should definitely have addressed long, long ago, and it really is unfortunate in 2017 that it's still a scenario that we face. I also think it's important to be making sure that our equal pay protections extend to all of the protected classes and aren't just limited to gender. So with that, we'll close and turn it over.
Okay, great.
Thank you. My name is Trish Garner. Thank you so much, Senator Taylor, Vice Chair Canope, and members of the committee. As maybe you know by now, I'm the State Public Policy Chair of American Association of University Women of Oregon. And I have very brief, I've been given the sort of the factual statistical charge, and I'll be brief and hopefully get some new info rather than the same old. But I have been working on this issue for a long, long time, and recently even more intensively. I cannot tell you how much I appreciate the genuine attention that you have given to this issue. And I've appreciated talking to all of you, even some of you who might not have been exactly gung-ho about the legislation. I really appreciate it. So the data is clear and convincing. Across all job categories, there is a persistent and pervasive wage gap. As a matter of fact, AEW did its first study reflecting a gap in 1896. And I'm sure you also know by now that women working full-time on average face an 80 cents on the dollar to what men earn a wage gap. African-American women are at 63 cents and Hispanic and Latina women 54 cents. Interestingly enough, women living in, for example, Northwest Oregon earn about half of men statewide. Over a lifetime of work, the total estimated loss of earnings of women compared to men is $700,000 for a high school graduate, $1.2 million for a college graduate, and $2 million for a professional school graduate. Lower career earnings result in even greater disparity in retirement income. Women 75 years and older are almost twice as likely as men to live in poverty. Education doesn't change this matrix. In fact, women are out-earned by men with less education. The typical woman with a graduate degree earns $5,000 less than the typical man with a bachelor's degree. 10 years after graduation, women are paid only 69% of what men are paid. The gender gap widens even further at higher levels of education. Some argue that women choose lower-paying or traditionally female jobs, but it's not only the fact that women generally receive lower wages than men, but they do so working in the same job in the same role. For example, average monthly earnings of women Oregonians are lower than that of men in every industry. To pick a few, real estate, rental, and leasing business, the ratio of women's to men's earnings is 77%, retail 69%, and interestingly enough, professional, scientific, and technical services 49%. As they move up the food chain, female managers make 77% of what male managers do, and female chief executives make less than 78%. Men also make more in female-dominated, and I put that in quote, jobs. Data recently collected from over 1.4 million workers found that while the wage gap in median earnings for women with children is 31%, married men with children get the highest pay among male earners. It's also the case as women enter a male-dominated field, the pay decreases. And as men enter a female-dominated field, the pay increases. Men are 85% more likely than women to be vice presidents or executive suite members in their mid-career, and 171% more likely to hold these positions late in their career. Conversely, by the time they reach the age of 60, more than 60% of women are still working in non-managerial roles, but less than 45% of men are still in this type of job. Let's clear away the noise. Why can employers pay women less than men? Because they can get away with it. There's only one thing a woman should have to do to get paid the same as a man. That's her job. I urge you to pass the House Bill 2005A with as amended. Thank you.
Chair Taylor, Vice Chair Knopf, and members of the committee. Did I say your name right? Knopf.
It's okay.
For the record, my name is Lori Cremona Wagner, and I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to testify in favor of Senate Bill 2005A. Let me tell you a little bit about who I am and my business experience. I'm coming here as a businesswoman to testify and why I believe this legislation is common sense to maintain Oregon's reputation as a very positive environment for business. I went to Stanford University for my bachelor's degree in architecture and then stayed for my master's degree in civil engineering. I started my career at a really small 200-person construction firm. Sorry, did I miss something?
I just wanted to go ahead and came before and testified before.
Yes.
And so I just wanted to understand, you're welcome to give the same testimony again. Are you interested? Is there something? I just wanted to understand what we were talking about. You want to talk about the bill coming out of the House or the bill, the Dash 25? You're welcome to continue on.
Well, I asked that very
question.
I remember
you very well. Very impressive
but nobody
background.
Nobody thought that I would. I don't think anyone thought that you were going to remember that I was kidding.
No, then go ahead. For
especially
the, then go ahead.
Me.
No. Impressive background.
Well, let's see. Why don't I do this then? If you remember, which I'm very happy about.
Yeah. Because that was before the House bill was passed.
Yeah.
And you, yes.
Yeah, exactly. So, what I would say, I think that from what I've heard today, the most important point is around that analysis. From a business person standpoint,
please.
I would like to say that every company, I think I turned to someone when we were talking about that, every company I've ever worked for would, no matter whether it was that 200-person construction firm or the 86,000-person software company that I work for today that actually provides HR cloud systems to do exactly what we're talking about, and it's automated. So you would every year come up with an annual compensation review that would automatically measure your company against all of these different factors that we're talking about and enable you to correct it. But this analysis would be really easy to put together, and actually I was surprised that anyone would actually not be doing this every single year. I wouldn't consider working for a company that didn't do an annual compensation review every year and have the systems in place to do it, even if it were on a spreadsheet. So I didn't actually think that it would be that burdensome based on the opposing testimony that I heard before.
Right.
So I think that was my main takeaway. And let's see. Everything that I would testify otherwise, if you remember, is what I would.
No, that's great. No, I appreciate coming, and I apologize. I just wanted. I do remember. You had a very impressive, like I said before, impressive background. The in the Dash 25 amendment, we're talking about things about limiting the damages to companies if you wanted to, if they were able to show that they had done a pay evaluation. I want to be clear that this is. The bill does not require an employer to do an evaluation. They will be in the Dash 25. They would be it would be left up to them to do it, and so it would be wise for a company to do it, because if they did not, and an employee came forward and said, "I think that there is a pay differential," then they would need to prove that they had done that is not the case, and so. There was some of the changes in the Dash 25, the limiting the damages, so that there would not be punitive or compensatory if they were eliminating the wage disparity, and then if the employee was due 2 years of back wages and costs and attorney fees, then they would have to pay that. Those are some of the, and then the bona fide reasons that were in the bill. I don't know if you had a chance to see any of those that actually, some of the things that are in there that pass out of the House, if you wanted, with your business experience, wanted to comment on any of those changes that we're discussing now, or anything else you wanted to add from either your last time you testified or what's happening now, or if there was something else you wanted to add.
Well, I know that this is going to be addressed. Some of these are going to be addressed by Whitney is still testifying, right? So I think she's...
Hopefully yeah. She's on the list.
Yep. Yeah, so I think Whitney was going to talk about those things specifically. So I'll just state that based on what I know and the amendments that I saw as a business person, I wholeheartedly support them.
Okay.
And am very, very in favor of this bill.
Okay, great. You have a question?
I do.
Thank you, Senator. No, please.
I don't have as good a memory as the chair does as it relates to your testimony last time. And it sounded like you were going to get into... your background with a large company that does software in this arena. And so my question really is, how easy and what cost do you think it would be to do this?
So my understanding is that... So when you say to do this, are you saying upholding the spirit of the overall bill to ensure that there are wage gaps? From my experience, it's been very, very simple. And this actually wasn't meant to be an advertisement for this product. I work for SAP, and so... The product that I'm talking about is one of a very, very, very large portfolio. But it's a cloud-based application, and I use it all the time. Once a year, we use this to do an annual compensation review. It's really, really easy to figure out what the wages of a particular role are in a particular area. You can use Glassdoor to find out the median total target earnings for any role in every area. And then what we do is we put the people into the system, factors about those people, and then it provides a visualization tool where you can see each person and where they stand versus the median total target earnings of the peers in the same group. And then we're given a pool of money, like any employer would, every year we look at what our budget is and what we might be able to afford in terms of earnings based on the performance of the previous year. And we assign that pool to correct any issues that we have with the people in that same band, we call it. So I know where everyone stands on the median. I can give promotions, I can assign bonuses and total target earnings changes through the system. It automatically rolls up, goes to our CEO, and boom, we're done. I mean, it couldn't be easier, it couldn't be faster. And it's a very, very large morale boost for everyone at the company, because we all know that this system is in place and that we're being paid fairly.
I think that's very interesting. Thank you. I felt a little bad that I cut you off, but now you went off on this tangent, and now I learned more, so I appreciate it. So thank you for being so flexible. I appreciate it.
Yeah,
okay,
thanks.
So let's go ahead, and I misspoke. I'm sorry, Ms. Squires, I think, did you want to testify on this bill, or are you here for 2186?
2186.
Okay, then I forget that I had done that. So Whitney Stark, though, I believe you wanted, Whitney, did you want to, I think that, I think we had a problem in the signing up. So I think you were signing, you want to test, yeah, I do. I would love for you to come testify. I'm so sorry. We have someone who's traveled here. I'm so sorry. I called you up, Whitney.
Nope.
I'm going to ask you to step back and we'll have Anne Kirschmer, who apparently has traveled a ways to get here. Oh, hello. Hi, how are you? And then we'll also have Amanda Dalton come up, please. And Steve Free. Thank you for saving me. So, okay, and then after that, then we'll have Whitney Starks come up, and we'll have, it looks like Bob Judo, Jundef, and, I'm sorry, and we'll have, Barbara Spencer after that. Those three. Okay, who would like to start? Maybe since she traveled the... How far did you come?
Huh?
How far did you travel?
Here in Salem.
Okay. All right. Well, I said we were having some miscommunication issues on the sign-in, but that was awesome. We needed a little levity. Did you walk?
Drive.
Did you drive, all right. Okay. Okay, well, thank you. I was going to apologize, but that's okay.
All good. All right. All good. Dear Senators, my name is Annie Kramer. I'm a sixth-generation farmer here in Oregon. I farm with my father and my brother, and we farm year-round, keeping our blueberries growing healthy and happy. Our harvest season lasts about 8 weeks, and that's if the summer heat or the rains don't take us out. Berries Northwest hires about 20 to 25 full-time employees. And then in the summertime, we hire about 125 to 200 harvest workers. I support the equal pay for equal work. It's what is fair. However, HB 2005A creates new liabilities for employers who are trying to do the right thing. It makes it difficult. It makes it more difficult to run HR on my farm and keep the workforce at harvest. I am opposed to the portions of this bill that create additional liabilities for my business. I support the provision of allowing the employer to evaluate and assess their inequities and then fix them without being forced into the courtroom. Our farm would use these opportunities to determine if we have a problem with the pay disparity and to fix it instead of spending thousands of dollars in the courtroom to deal with the problem. Farming is challenging work, and each mandate that's passed here in Salem layers a burden on my business that makes it more difficult for farming in Oregon. The ability to proactively cure what would give us our family farm the tools that we need to ensure that there are not pay disparities. Another important clarification would be to allow for quality and quantity of piecework rate. Although not unique in aviculture, many farmers pay by the piece for the picking of the fruit and the vegetables. Under piece rate systems, workers are given the opportunity to earn more than the stated hourly rates based on a productive incentive. This is common for blueberries, cherries, and other crops. Piece rate can be based on quality and or quality for the work produced. Quantity example is paid by the pound or by the bucket for the fruit. Quality example for blueberries, cherries, when the quality is low and poor, the piece rate goes up or is by hourly. This applies mostly to the second or third time picking the crop. These rates can vary depending upon the quality and quantity. Piece rate pay is widely used in aviculture, and I ask that you ensure that we are allowed to pay the employees for this job on the different compassion levels that working with the piece rate basis. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Chair Taylor, my name is Steve Free. I own Mr. Ritter Plumbing in Portland, Oregon, and Southwest Washington. I do want to preface this. I'm also was the leadership chair for National Federation of Independent Business, so I kind of want to speak for small business also. But and normally I have written comments that I get to prepare ahead of time, but I was just asked a little while ago to testify, so you may get a little bit of Steve unplugged, but I apologize if I get carried away. But anyway, First of all, we as an employer want to consider ourselves the employer of choice. In fact, when my wife and I bought the business back in 1999, one of the first things we did is we actually do service plumbing and drain cleaning, and we actually went after trying to hire women drain cleaners, which we trained them ourselves, and they made anywhere between $60,000 and $80,000 doing that job. I actually right now currently have a female apprentice, okay? And with the apprenticeship, the state even dictates what I pay those folks, right? Depending on what period they're in, okay? So that system's already set up. I cannot comment on this, that Dash 25 amendments, because I have not seen those yet. I'm confused as to how this bill really fixes the wage discrimination piece. I really see it as more of this false protection for the where I look at it as we do the right thing. When someone mentioned the previous lady from Stanford that went to Stanford, she was talking about the analysis and the software and stuff. As a matter of fact, we just had a manager meeting yesterday, okay, of which two of my manager on the management team are female. And we have the minimum wage issue coming up in July, the minimum wage is going up. We do not have any employees that are at or below minimum wage, obviously, but they're all paid above it right now. But we still looked at our customer loyalty team and went through each person and looked at the amount of time they've been working for us, time and position, and then the quality of the work and what kind of job they're doing. And we adjusted everybody up in anticipation ahead of time for that minimum wage increase. So we do an analysis every year in terms of looking at our employees and are we fairly compensating. As a business owner in this day and age, as hard as it is to get people, you need to be doing that. And most people are. You have to be able to be competitive there out in the marketplace. The bigger issue I have is I can be doing those things, but I can still have somebody, a disgruntled employee possibly, that can file a claim against me, okay? So now what happens is I choose to spend $50,000 to $100,000 fighting it or settle it. So I look at this more as an issue of helping the lawyers being able to drum up more business than really helping the wage discrimination piece. The other question I have is we have EEOC. Why don't we force the existing laws we have? That's the most important issue. We have laws in place for all this stuff now. Let's enforce them. We've got to get away from this mentality of let's go out there and create laws for the 0.5% or 1% of people that are doing it wrong and suck in all the other 99% that are trying to do it right and penalize them also, okay? We need to flip that around. And so those are my comments. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Dalton.
Chair Taylor and members of the committee, Amanda Dalton, I'm here on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association. Our members, as you have heard this afternoon from many, support equal pay and believe that regardless of your race, color, religion, sex, sexual orientation, national origin, marital status, disability or age, or veteran status as proposed in the Dash 25, all deserve equal pay. But for us, pay equity is about fairness. It's not about a courtroom, which is where the bill or amendments as drafted really force this conversation over pay inequity. I'm really going to focus my comments on the equal pay analysis as proposed in the Dash 25 and really what we felt was the most important component missing from the House version of the bill. So thank you, Chair Taylor, and members of the committee for really allowing us to have a conversation on this very important component. The value of an equal pay analysis for employers, both private and public, is to allow an employer to evaluate and assess their pay inequities if they exist and then fix them without being forced into a courtroom, so before a jury or a bench trial, an ability to proactively cure. You heard a couple of weeks ago from the Department of Administrative Services where they mentioned and then later provided a 2015 pay equity study that is on OLIS today that they had completed for the executive branch 34,000 plus state employees. Specifically, this 2015 report found, quote, a consistent pattern of pay difference in the overall executive branch workforce, end quote. What the report shows is that in Oregon state government, executive branch females earn 83 cents for every dollar earned by a male coworker, while minorities earn 91 cents compared to their non-minority colleagues. I bring up this data only because the state is also trying to cure this problem, because you also heard from them what they're trying to do to address it, and it's taking time. The state wants to do the right thing, and so do your private employers. But a study or an evaluation to cure without keeping the employer out of a courtroom isn't a real tool for your public and private employers. If you allow the employer to identify the problem, again, if they have one, before they are sued, and not wait till they are in a courtroom to learn that they have a problem, you encourage companies, both large and small, to solve that problem without the costly exercise of going to court. Again, I want to thank Senator Taylor and the members of the committee for working us to draft this amendment. I imagine Senator Taylor and Knope have seen way more of us in the last 48 hours than you care to in the future. But I do want to talk just briefly to the 25s, and all of us have seen these for maybe 30 minutes. I do think I read them the same way that Senator Gelser does, in that the pay evaluation isn't something that stops these cases from going to a bench or a jury trial. It's drafted more like a jury instruction to limit damages that the jury or the judge could award. It's also drafted to currently limit damages to those that do not pay, that do the equal pay analysis, to 2 years of back pay and attorney fees, and shield them from punitive and compensatory damages. I'll point out that back pay is a form of compensatory damages. I believe the bill that came over to you from the House version also limited that to 2 years of back pay, so I'm not sure what else it would protect you from in terms of compensatory. And that the 25s is drafted limit punitive to intentional and repeat offenders, which we think is a good change, but something that I don't think the pay equity analysis would necessarily need to protect you from if you're not a repeat offender or intentional. And then finally, the jury instruction to limit the award to a plaintiff requires the employer to cure, 100% cure. I think those state of Oregon figures show us that this is hard, that it's not something that happens overnight, and that this was a pay analysis that only focused on half of the protected classes referenced in the bill, the 2015 report. I do want to say that an ability to proactively cure isn't just about a defense. It's about letting employers get it right. It's a training tool that hands a tool to Oregon's private and public employers to do a better job, to fix what's broken, and to proactively conduct pay equity evaluations that ensure fair pay for all of their employees in our storefronts, in our office rooms, in our boardrooms, not in our courtrooms. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions? Okay, thank you. All right, so let's bring up Whitney Sparks and Bob from Disability Rights Oregon, and Barbara Spencer. Just give me one moment, please. We have this request here. Ms. Sparks, you wanted to have someone on the phone? Is this no? Is there miscommunication?
No.
No, okay.
Not me.
No, okay. There's someone who maybe signed up via phone to testify. But I think we're just going to go ahead with who we have here. Okay, who would like to start?
I'm happy to go.
Okay, great. Hello, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Taylor and members of the committee. My name is Whitney Stark. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. I'm an attorney. I practice employment and labor law. I'm going to try and address some of the concerns and issues that I've heard raised today, including questions that committee members have raised. And feel free to ask me other questions. I'll do my very best to answer them, of course, with the same caveat that everyone else has had, that I have not had very much time to study the Dash Amendment. So I will do my best. So I do also want to put on the record that I continue to have very strong concerns about the affirmative defense that was in the minority report of the House bill. And in particular, because that type of affirmative defense does not allow the discrimination that's occurring, the unequal pay, to be redressed in any way, it would allow discrimination to continue. And the dash, so that causes, to me, a lot of concern because it's essentially allowing continued discrimination. I'm cautiously optimistic from my read of the dash 25 amendment that it does go very far in striking a closer balance between providing direct redress of the discrimination that occurred, but also allowing an employer an opportunity to cure it without going through the whole entire expense of a lawsuit. And so to address some of that concern that I've heard a lot about, I do believe that this version of the amendment could serve as a very important deterrent to lawsuits. I've heard concerns that this is inviting lawsuits, but I don't think that's accurate. This provision would really deter to any potential plaintiff. It could cause a very powerful deterrent because there would be no incentive for them to go to court. In the first place, they would have gotten their back pay or a large amount of it if there's some dispute. And so that would cause a really decrease, I think, a lot of disputes that would happen. So I think that's important to understand with this. To address one of Senator Gelser's questions earlier, I'd like to try and answer it. You raised a question about whether or not familial, what I believe you were asking about is familial status, so somebody with kids would be protected. And the answer is no, that's not a direct protected category under the bill. But I do think this scenario under which you described, that this bill would not allow somebody to pay differential based on that, because it provides some important protections against sex and marital status. And I would argue that the scenario you described would fall under one of those. And if you read the bona fide the situation in which you are allowed to pay difference, you have to meet a set of criteria that includes you can't have a traditional notion or based on sort of traditional perceptions of those protected categories. And I think, for example, single mother, I would argue that's the idea that they can't accomplish as much work. You also have to show there's a business necessity for the bona fide factor. And other things, a job related, I believe, is another list. And so it does provide a fair amount of protection. It can't just be an arbitrary reason that an employer pays somebody different. It really has some teeth to it. Lastly, I want to raise a couple of concerns I have about some of the technical changes. I understand the repealing 230, and I'm not, I just haven't had enough time to understand there are whether or not that's a rollback of some of the important protections that are included in 230 or if those are incorporated in the changes. So I think it's important to understand that and make sure that the rights that are in 230 are preserved in this bill. I also want to address the punitive damages, and as drafted in here, I believe that the punitive damages is so restricting that it's means virtually that there is little opportunity for somebody to bring a punitive damages argument because it requires such a high burden. So those are my concerns, and I hope it addresses some questions. If you have any more, I'm happy to try and answer them.
Okay. Okay. All right. Who's next?
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Taylor, Vice Chair Knopp, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Barbara Spencer, Chair of the Oregon Commission for Women. And the Oregon Commission for Women, in its role of promoting equity for women of Oregon, strongly support HB 2005A in its original form. And we appreciate what you're trying to do to provide Oregon with the opportunity to promote equal pay, fair treatment, and economic security for women and families. We need not go through all the reasons for why women are deserving of equal pay. You've heard that, I know. So we'll go on in terms of sort of why we believe that sort of we need a bill to really close the gaps in Oregon's current pay discrimination. And there are really three important ways. We believe the proposed bill sort of closes judicially created loopholes in the factor other than sex, race, defense to pay discrimination and ensures the bona fide job-related factors be used. That's good. That's positive. Second, the bill guarantees against the use of salary history information to screen job applicants or set pay. And then third, the bill makes practice that every discriminatory paycheck is an unfair compensation practice. These practices would close the gaps in existing Oregon's current fair employment practice and equal pay laws. We appreciate sort of what you've done now in the Dash 25 amendment. It obviously needs some more reviews from some of our sort of colleagues here, but I think you've opened the dialogue in terms of looking at it from a broader perspective and sort of a broader conversation and bringing in some of these other aspects. We want to make sure that sort of the original intent of the HB 2000 5A sort of exists and sort of is not diluted in any way, and we don't want in any way the new amendments to really sort of move backwards, but to help us to move forward with sort of more legal safeguards and practices, and we urge you to sort of take that practice as you move forward.
Okay, thank you. Before we go to our next person, we have two other bills that are on the agenda today, and I should have said something earlier. I don't know if people are able to stay till 5, so we could do those in addition, or do you want to hold them? We can hold them over to next week. We have one, two, three. Is that okay with you, or is that it's okay?
I have a town hall.
Okay, so we'll. I'm so sorry, and I owe an apology to Ms. Squire. I should have done something about this earlier. I apologize. So, House Bill 2186 and 2263. We're going to go ahead and hold those over. Do I have to do anything official other than say that?
That's
okay, fantastic. And I owe such an apology, Ms. Squires. I'm so sorry. Should have done that earlier. And but we'll do those on. We'll hear those on Monday. So. But I'm sure they learned a lot about pay equity here today. So, Bob, nice to see you.
Thank you, Chair Taylor and members of the committee. My name is Bob Jundef.
Mm-hmm. I apologize for mispronouncing your name.
It happens daily. I'm the Executive Director of Disability Rights Oregon, and I'm here to speak particularly to the protections that House Bill 2005 would provide for people with disabilities. And I just want to give a brief explanation of why that is. Our organization is a nonprofit that receives primarily federally funding to advocate for the rights of people with disabilities. About a quarter of the work that we do is to help people with employment problems, particularly in negotiating their way through the complex benefits that they have to rely upon. Because of their disability and their attempts to get back to work, find work, and stay on the job. The Americans with Disabilities Act, which is a primary law in that area, has been with us now for 28 years. Federal protections have been with us for almost 50 years, and still there is persistent discrimination in the workplace against people with disabilities. I provided to the committee some data to support that position, and if you take a look at that, you'll see, of course, that the pay differential for people with disabilities across the nation is about 37%, very significant. Disabilities can arise at birth. They can arise as a result of an accident, a disease. Many of our service people come back from service with disabilities. In fact, I was very pleased to see veterans added to this bill because I think one of the reasons that it's important to have them in there is about 20% of veterans have some type of significant disability. And if you look at their the employment discrimination that they may suffer, I would suggest that much of it is attributed to brain injury, post-traumatic stress disorder, and other types of acquired disabilities that they come back with. And so this is particularly significant for them. And so what I wanted to do is just give you a sense of what that experience is like for a person with disabilities. First of all, an individual, and this could be a psychiatric disability, an emotional disability, physical disability, sensory disability, people know that they're going to have a more difficult time finding jobs, even if they're qualified for that job, especially if they're qualified for that job. If they're ready, willing, and able to work, they're at a disadvantage. They know that. It's difficult to find work, and then once one is hired, it's difficult to retain work. And so people are oftentimes in a state of anxiety. The questions have been raised about, well, there's going to be employees out there who are looking to challenge employers over the pay differential. In fact, I'd suggest that people are desperate to keep their jobs and are very unlikely to challenge the pay differential because it's so hard to find work. It's so hard to retain work, particularly when you're looking at the types of unemployment rates that people with disabilities have. And as the data I've provided you show that traditionally and ongoing, people with disabilities have twice the unemployment rate of able-bodied people. It's twice the rate. And that has unfortunately been a consistent figure. There's been a lot of efforts, including efforts on our end, to try to put a chunk in that data, but that data remains firm. And so even if we have employers, and of course we do, who want to do the right thing, we still have difficulties in moving the dial on that particular problem. I'll just say that I particularly, I did take a quick glance at the Dash 25, and I like the idea of encouraging employers to do reviews of their employees to see how they're paying people and seeing if there is a differential in their payment. I think that's a very positive thing. In many parts of the Americans with Disabilities Act, there are requirements for particularly public employers to do reviews of their accessibility of their buildings, accessibility of their employment places, to help them to get ahead of the dial and have completely welcoming work environments. So I think that's a positive thing. I particularly want to thank Representative Leininger, who was very concerned that people with disabilities be included in this bill. A very positive step, and we support the bill.
Okay, thank you. All right. Does anybody have any other questions? Thank you for coming and for being patient. Okay, so we just have one last panel. It's going to be Andrea Balbus. Tim Cowan and Kathy, what is the last name, Goss? Okay. So here we have Andrea signed up in support of the bill. Mm-hmm. Mr. Cowan signed up as neutral, and Kathy signed up as against. So we have a little, we have one of each. It's our last panel.
Should Tim sit between the two?
Oh, there we go. He can be. We'll have Tim start. Right. How's that sound? And we have to be mindful. I'm keeping my committee over, and I'm sorry. So we'll have to, at this point, I'm sorry to shortchange you here, but.
Chair Taylor, committee members, for the record, my name is Tim Cowan. I looked at the changes, and I don't know how to comply with them if I had my own company. So here's a couple questions that I had. I don't understand compensation. Does that include risk by the employee or the manager, creating a new job, development of a new product or service that employment depends on its success, has more experience or knowledge than the owner or the manager, their previous experience of success, has a proven ability to motivate and create value in employees. The company's dependent on the individual to maintain and provide a competitive advantage, has a reputation that provides immediate and ongoing credibility. Section 2. I don't know what I can, the reason why I'm talking about this, I don't know what I can ask during an interview. So I didn't know how to define comparable character. How does an employer prevent a change in that? This might apply if an employee experiences a negative action, such as criticism, documentation, consideration for promotion, termination. And it could be a negative reaction if you take action like termination on the employee. General, how can an employer explore past behavior of the employee? It's not uncommon for an employee to have charged a former employer of the same infraction. For example, one that I had is I had to take care of a sexual harassment claim. I got the two of them individually, talked to them, brought them together, and said, are you comfortable with what we've done? Yes, well, then I'm not going to put it in your personnel file. It was about 2 weeks later, here comes the state, and they criticized me for how I did it. And I said, grab the file. And I grabbed the file, and I said, here, there's everything. I told them I wouldn't put it in their personal file. I didn't say I wouldn't keep one. I'll do this real quick. Here's one other example. I had a manager and an operations officer in a branch that I terminated, had a part-time employee that was a single parent, asked her if she would manage the branch for me. She said yes. Well, then I'm going to save money because I'm replacing a part-time. I'm replacing those two full-times, and I told her, this is how much I'm going to save. I'll split it with you. You get half of what I save. And it wasn't until later that I ran into the chairman of the board of the bank. He said, do you know I have the single highest paid part-time employee in the bank? I said, no, but she's worth it. One last one. I don't know if I could do this either. I had an employee that's wife had terminal cancer, and when she had chemo, she would be sick a number of different times, and I told him, I don't want you to have to worry about work. You know what you need to do, so take care of your wife. So I don't know if that would fit this criteria or not.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, so now we will hear. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And so now we have Kathy Goss.
Thank you, Chair Taylor and Vice Chair Knopf. I appreciate you listening. And I'd like to give you an example. I'm here to testify that this puts me under the perception of perhaps breaking the rules in this. You just did that because you chose the male over the female, which is a gender-protected class. And I wanted to be first. That's what you do to me. I'm a commercial real estate appraiser, and my husband and I own a large company here in Salem, and we appraise properties, commercial properties, and properties of all sorts. So our fees vary from maybe even $400 for a job up to sometimes as much as $30,000, $40,000 for a job, depending on what we're appraising, of course, and how much time and effort it takes, how much skill, and that sort of thing. What happens, and I had a complaint filed against me for a gender discrimination. What we base how we assign jobs as owners of the firm, it depends on so many things. It depends on whether the appraiser is specialized in some area, and that often happens. We have people that specialize in farms, and they would be pretty darn close to useless on a multi-story building, things like that. The size of the job, what's coming into the office. I have so many appraisers. If I have a dozen new jobs that come in over a month, I have to determine who's going to finish the job they have in time to accept a new job, in time to get it out by what we've agreed to do, by providing it by a specific date. All these things enter into who is going to receive what job as it goes along. And this gives people the perception, perhaps, if two men that are doing farms have happened to have large farms come on for an appraisal, be a job, at the same time, they're earning much more money right then than the women that perhaps are in a different field or a different area. And it's not that we are discriminating. It's the perception that will get us into litigation and into court. So doing a full year's pay on this really is useless because it just entirely depends on the market, what's been charged and how big the job was and what the fee was. Okay. So I'm not in favor of this.
So I have a question probably for you, Chair. So if she did a pay analysis, mm-hmm. would that come out?
So under the bill, under the scenario that she placed, I mean, I'm not a judge, but the some of the things that she brought forward that is dependent on experience. And so the only thing that if a female employee in that scenario were to say that she was not allowed to do the appraisal of a farm solely because she was a woman, she would have to prove that. And I assume Ms. Goss would say, well, no, this person was doing the appraisal because this person had experience appraising farms. They had more, you know, whatever the scenario was. So that would have to be, that would be the case there, but the judge would have to decide that.
But again, what would it require me to do that? If this person was adamant, I would have to come up with a log. I would have to do a great deal of paperwork before I got into a settlement area or before I went to court.
The bill has what are called bona fide reasons, and the bona fide reason would be in the example that you gave. I assume you meant that the person that was doing the an appraisal that had a higher compensation was because they had. I assume you're implying that they had more experience, and so that's why they were given the opportunity to do that. That you weren't solely giving it to that person because they were a male. So the things that you would produce, for example, would be the resume, past experience of doing appraisals, that type of thing. And under the bill, with the changes in the -25 amendment, if the in the scenario that you gave, if a female employee were to file a civil action and were to go into the court, they would say, well, I want to see the pay analysis, and you would say, well, here's the pay analysis, and here are the bona fide reasons for why the male appraiser was being paid more. And then the judge would say, well, that's either justified or not justified. And if it was not justified, then you would go to court. But if it was justified, then it would just, the case would not go forward. So that's
right. But obviously the person that filed it felt that they were qualified. I, as the owner, didn't feel they were.
So as long
that
as you...
all the time.
And so as long as there was not a decision made solely based in that example you gave, solely based on gender, the sex rather, then that would be, but you didn't make, it sounds like you didn't make the decision based on that. You made it based on something
on market
else.
And experience.
Right,
and
so that's what you would prove. I have the interest of time. So thank you so much for coming to testify. And so now you've been waiting patiently here for so long. And Ms. Balba, so can you tell us a little bit about your background and your...
Yep.
So thank you.
Chair Taylor and members of the committee, I'm honored to be here. My name is Dr. Andrea Balbus. I received my PhD in geochemistry from Oregon State University in June of 2016. When I was 34 years old, I was waiting tables, and my highest educational accomplishment was a high school diploma. So in that short time, I ascended the ranks of scientific academia, and it was very difficult, and I had many obstacles. And so I would go to the Boys and Girls Club, and I would talk to all the little kids about science, and that would keep me motivated. Mostly, I was most inspired by the little girls there who were not familiar with a lady scientist. And upon graduation from Oregon State, I was offered a postdoctoral fellowship at California Institute of Technology, which it can be argued is the most prestigious scientific institution in the world. And the next step for me would be a tenure track position as a research scientist in a research institution. And from talking with my peers, it is highly likely that I would expect a salary that's at least $10,000 per year less than anybody else that has equivalent background and skills. So given the status of my current loans and my complete lack of retirement, I might have to leave science. And that breaks my heart. But it breaks my heart for all those little girls at the Boys and Girls Club, because they should not have added obstacles to ascend to their dreams. And so as you can see, I wholeheartedly back this bill in hopes that it could help all the little girls behind me. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you. And I know it sounds like you've had it's pretty impressive, though. You should be proud of yourself. It's amazing. So you didn't start, you said you were 34 before you started?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's incredible. Yeah. So how long did it take for you to get your PhD?
I was 43 when I walked at Oregon State with my advisor. And, you know, I'm proud of the accomplishment.
Yeah.
And given the obstacles, I kept on keeping on. But it's a sad reality to face.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it's obviously this is my number one priority for the legislative session is this bill. And I understand where you're coming from, and it's very important that we make certain that we do not have wage disparity based on the protected classes that we mentioned. And thank you so much for sharing your story. And I'm kind of glad that you were last because you really made us is a good reminder for why this is so important. So thank you for taking your time to come. We appreciate it. Okay, so committee members, sorry we stayed over. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2005A. As I mentioned before, House Bill 2186 and House Bill 2263, we will hear those on Monday, May 1st, 2017, and I'm going to adjourn the Senate Committee on Workforce.